to make during this two-week meeting, and I want to take just a moment to thank the congregation and the eldership here for inviting me to teach and for supporting me during this time, and for all that all of you have done to make this meeting what it's been for and to all of us. I have very much enjoyed your young people in the 10 sessions that we have shared together downstairs. I think that I can say that they are one of the finest groups of young people that we have ever had at a two-week meeting that I knew anything about. They've listened attentively when I've lectured to them. They've discussed reasonably when we've discussed things together. I find no fault in them in the classes this week and last. And I can be a pretty good fault finder sometimes when I try to, but I just think they're a terrific group of young people. And that reflects positively on you who are having to do with raising them as well. Everything's been great here in Des Moines during this 2 weeks, and I thank you and thank the Father for you. Now we have one more subject left to cover in this class pertaining to the concept of divorce. And although divorce is listed by itself without remarriage on the sheet that you may have, remarriage was mentioned in the material that I received, so we'll talk about these two to the degree that we're able. And I want to begin by reading New Testament passages pertinent to this subject. First of all, Matthew 5, verses 31 and 32. It hath been said, whosoever shall put away his wife, let him give her a writing of divorcement. But I say unto you, that whosoever shall put away his wife, save for the cause of fornication, causeth her to commit adultery, and whosoever shall marry her that is divorced, committeth adultery. And now Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 9. The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him, and saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And he answered and said unto them, have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. They say unto him, why did Moses command? Why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? He saith unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whosoever marrieth her which is put away, doth commit adultery. That's as far as we'll go with that one. I do want to read the parallel passage in Mark chapter 10. And I do have reasons for reading these. In spite of the time that it takes, I think just the reading of them says more than I will be able to say about them. I do hope to leave time for discussion at the end, but I think it's imperative to read these in our hearing for review. Mark 10:2. The Pharisees came to him and asked him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife? Tempting him. And he answered and said unto them, what did Moses command you? And they said, Moses suffered to write a bill of divorcement and to put her away. And Jesus answered and said unto them, for the hardness of your heart he wrote you this precept, but from the beginning of the creation God made them male and female. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh, so then they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. And in the house his disciples asked him again of the same matter, and he answered, and he said unto them, whosoever shall put away his wife and marry another committeth adultery against her. And if a woman shall put away her husband and be married to another, she committeth adultery. Luke chapter 16, verse 18. Just one verse there. Whosoever putteth away his wife and marrieth another committeth adultery, and whosoever marrieth her that is put away from her husband committeth adultery. John chapter 4, verses 16 through 18. This is the woman at the well. Jesus saith unto her, go, call thy husband, and come hither. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, thou hast well said, I have no husband, for thou hast had five husbands, and he whom thou now hast is not thy husband. In that saidst thou truly. Romans chapter 7, verses 2 and 3. For the woman which hath an husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband. So then, if while her husband liveth, she be married to another man, she shall be called an adulteress. But if her husband be dead, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she be married to another man. And 1 Corinthians chapter 7, we'll just read verses 1 through 16. Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and every woman her own husband. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. But I speak this by permission, and not of commandment. For I would that all men were even as myself. But every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner, another after that. I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. And unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband, but and if she depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife. But to the rest speak I, not the Lord. If any brother hath a wife that believeth not, and she be pleased to dwell with him, let him not put her away. And the woman which hath an husband that believeth not, and if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were your children unclean, but now are they holy. But if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us to peace. For what knowest thou, O wife, whether thou shalt save thy husband? Or how knowest thou, O man, whether thou shalt save thy wife? And then verse 39, perhaps we ought to read, the wife is bound by the law as long as her husband liveth. But if her husband be dead, she is at liberty to be married to whom she will, only in the Lord. I think all of us know internally that our position regarding divorce and remarriage must be based on Scripture, which we have read, and not on human experience, which we may or may not have had. We should not allow our overall approach to center on this case or that case of some unfortunate people that we know about who are involved in the process of divorce and remarriage. We should not allow our position to be swayed by what we know of various people's situation. We can't be swayed by sympathy because we are bound by our allegiance to God and our allegiance to His Word. And I mention this because I believe very often personal involvement with divorced and hurting people, which we should have, but that personal involvement sometimes results in an inadvertent personal bias toward a particular view of divorce and remarriage. And we have to guard against being so swayed by sympathy for hurting people, especially if we're related to them or if we're close to them personally, that we ignore or reject Scripture on this subject. It's possible to have such sympathy with our fellow man, in particular with our brethren, as to actually be guilty of rebellion against God. Now, it's very difficult for us on this or most other subjects to avoid arguing from human experience. It's easy for us on this subject particularly to list case after tragic case that we have known about and so play on one another's emotions that any sensitive soul cries out finally, just let them do what they want and it'll be all right with me. Maybe God will forgive. Just let them do what they want. I bear, as many of you bear, in my psyche, the emotional scars of multiple marital quandaries and perplexities and predicaments that have been brought to me year after year. Many of you bear the same thing. But we as Christians do not find moral guidance in human experience. We find it in the Scriptures, and then we apply Scripture in order to help us evaluate experience. As we then look at the New Testament, taking into account all of the data that the Lord has given us there, we need to be willing to be biblical, even rather than being logical, if it seems that there may be a conflict between being biblical and logical. Because God's ways are not our ways, neither are His thoughts our thoughts. As the heavens are above the earth, so are God's thoughts above our thoughts. And the way that seemeth right unto a man is the way that ends in the ways of death many times. O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. There are things that may seem like they would be the best to you and me personally. that the Lord says are not the best. And souls are at stake on this issue. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. There is unfolded in the Bible a chain of progressive revelation. We ought not to fear that expression or the idea of progressive revelation. Sometimes we shy away from the thought because we hear our Mormon friends talking about progressive revelation, and they bring it right on up to today. The president or the leader of their church has revelation all the time. So that's what they refer to by this. Now, there was a point at which this stopped, of course. We're all in agreement on that here. But there is a chain of progressive revelation unfolded in the Bible. God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spake in time past unto our fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days spoken unto us by His Son. Back in the patriarchal age, they were led by starlight, a little bit of light, a little revelation from God. Led Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. In the Mosaic Age, it's often referred to as the Moonlight Age, where they had more light from God, but still not as much as we have today. We come through the time of John the Baptist, which has been referred to as a Twilight Age, and finally the Sunlight Age of the Christian era, where the fulfillment of Malachi is come to pass in Malachi chapter 4, verse 2. Unto you that fear my name, the prediction was made, shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings, and you shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall. And that's been fulfilled now in the Christian age, so that we now live in a time of the perfection of God's revealed will for mankind, and God's toleration of things that he used to wink at is at an end. The Apostle Paul said so in the 14th chapter of the book of Acts when he was talking to a group of heathen and pagan people, speaking of God who in time past suffered all nations to walk in their own way. Nevertheless, he left not himself without witness, and you're familiar with the passage there. A little later on at Mars Hill, he said much the same thing, but a little more pointedly in Acts 17, verse 30. The times of this ignorance God winked at, but now commandeth all men everywhere to repent. So in times of lesser illumination, like the patriarchal, like the Mosaic Age, there is a lesser responsibility and hence less punishment. But in times like ours, of greater revelation, there is a greater responsibility and so a greater punishment possible to be received. He that despised Moses' law died without mercy under two or three witnesses. Of how much sore punishment, suppose ye, shall he be thought worthy who hath trodden underfoot the Son of God and hath counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified an unholy thing and hath done despot to the Spirit of grace. Hebrews 10, 28 and 29. We will be judged by a severer standard than those who lived under the Mosaic era. Old Testament examples, then, of all sorts of marital infidelities, all kinds of marital irregularities back in the Old Testament, are somewhat irrelevant to a discussion today when we're referring to our responsibility now in the Christian age. God ordained marriage at the very beginning. Ordained it to be monogamous, ordained it to be heterosexual, ordained it to be permanent. Cleaving, gluing. We have glues today where when you bind two pieces of wood together with them, you can work to get those two pieces apart, and the wood itself will break rather than that glued joint breaking apart. This is the way a marriage is supposed to be in the eyes of God so far as our earthly life is concerned, that only death will end it. That is God's ideal. That's what He expects us to live by. Now, in the 19th chapter of the book of Matthew, the Lord said there, as we read a moment ago, Moses allowed concession on this because of the hardness of your hearts, that is, your Jewish hearts. But from the beginning, it hath not been so. This shows the permanence of the divine ideal. The original ordinance has never been abrogated. It's never been altered or superseded in any permanent sense. It was altered temporarily in the days of Moses, but it continues in force now. God instituted marriage, and He did it according to His own design, in His own wisdom. He is the one who worketh all things after the counsel of His own will, and for His own reasons He made marriage and made us such as He did. Because of the hardness of hearts, He allowed a relaxation of that standard, but now Jesus says in Matthew 19, God is getting ready to inaugurate a new covenant based on better promises, and He says that the period of relaxation is coming to an end. It is God and God alone who determines whether or if it is ever proper for a Christian to divorce and remarry. Now, two passages I read, the one in Matthew 5, verses 31 and 32, and Matthew 19, verses 3 through 9, do allow an exception where divorce and remarriage are permitted. Often it's brought up that Mark chapter 10 omits this exception, though it is a parallel to Matthew chapter 19. And I think we should say just a few words about that. We should notice, first of all, that Mark's account, which we read in Mark chapter 10, does not deny the exception which is stated in the book of Matthew chapter 19. Mark and Matthew are recording the same historical incident, and they are recording some of the same statements of Jesus. And unless you're willing to say that Matthew chapter 19 is inaccurate, and thereby say that you do not believe in the inerrancy of Scripture, then the conversation recorded in Mark chapter 10 is the conversation in which Jesus did state the exception, even though Mark chooses to leave that out. Often this happens in the book of Mark. Mark was writing from a different person for a different purpose than Matthew was. He was writing for an entirely different group of people than Matthew was. And we don't have time to go into all that. I think in a group like this, we're pretty aware of why the different gospel accounts were written. But this happens on a number of subjects, that Mark will make a flat statement that Jesus said, and Matthew will include that statement but give the exception that Jesus gave. For instance, in the 12th chapter of the book of Matthew, and the 8th chapter of the book of Mark. This is an evil and adulterous generation, Jesus says. There will be no sign given it. That's what Mark says, Mark 8:12. Matthew puts it this way, same words of Jesus, Matthew 12:39. There shall be no sign given it save the sign of the prophet Jonas. And so Matthew there gives the exception that was stated by Jesus, but which Mark, for whatever reason, left out. Yes, Mark wrote by the inspiration of God, but so did Matthew, and when we put them together, we have the full and complete statement of what was said. So Mark, as often in other passages, merely omitted a detail which Matthew included in his comments on the same event. Those who argue that Mark chapter 10, and I've met many such people, who argue that Mark chapter 10 gives Jesus' real view, are denying the accuracy of the book of Matthew. There's no way around that I can see. To conclude that Mark excluded it in order to give the impression that Jesus did not say it is to accuse Mark of trying to leave a false impression if Matthew is correct. And I assume we all believe that Matthew is correct in recording what Jesus said. We may differ on what he meant by it, but we all believe, I hope, that Matthew is accurate in recording what Jesus said. Ordinarily, we take the more detailed of two statements on the same subject as considered to be the more complete. That's almost invariably true, unless we have a textual problem, which we do sometimes in the Bible, but we certainly don't hear on this subject. So that's not something we need to discuss at this time. In other words, there cannot be a contradiction between two inerrant gospel accounts. And there is no contradiction here. We have, as often, detail mentioned in one case that is not mentioned in the other. If we make the statement, whoever drives on this road, except an ambulance driver on call, and exceeds the speed limit is breaking the law, all of us can understand what's being said there. That you're breaking the law if you drive down that road exceeding the speed limit, unless you're an ambulance driver on call. There is an exception allowed by that kind of a law. And this is the same structure to the statement that Jesus made regarding fornication, divorce, and remarriage. Jesus did not derive his position on this subject from Shammai. Shammai was the founder of the Sadducees. The Pharisees and the Sadducees used to fight one another on this issue as well as many others. And now Jesus, talking to Pharisees, might seem to them to be siding with Shammai, but Jesus actually here is teaching God's view on divorce and remarriage. If Shammai agrees with that, then he happens to agree with God's view. I don't think Jesus is attempting here to pit Sadducee against Pharisee. He could care less about that. He's teaching God's view on this, which happened to be closer to what the Sadducees taught than what the Pharisees taught. There is this exception allowed by the Lord. And I don't believe we should try to find a way to get around that when the Lord allows this exception. There have been many, many attempts to try to nullify this exception. None of them that I've ever heard have ever made sense to me. And I believe, actually, that the complexity of the arguments involved when people are trying to abrogate this exception is probably due to the difficulty that's inherent in avoiding the teaching of Matthew 19, verse 9. Let me give you an example of what is often done on this passage in case you don't know, although I'm sure many of you do know because discussion on this subject has been rampant through the years, as it obviously would be on a subject so important to us. The idea is often propounded, for example, that what Jesus is actually referring to here is betrothal unfaithfulness. Betrothal being the engagement which in Jewish society, as well as sometimes in Greek and Roman society, was considered to have some binding force to it, so that we're talking here about a divorce before the marriage has even been actually in existence, before the marriage definitely has been consummated. And this, to the people who advocate this position, helps them to avoid the sundering of a genuine marriage. That's the idea behind it, that the Lord wouldn't allow the sundering of a genuine marriage, even for the case of adultery, but he would allow the sundering of a betrothal. That's the point that they're making. Now, the obvious problem with this view right off is that Jesus and the Pharisees are discussing marriage. They're not discussing betrothal here at all. That's not a part of the issue. The Pharisees' original question and Jesus' original answer and the Pharisees' subsequent question and the Old Testament passages that are quoted all are on the subject of marriage and refer only to married people. How then can the idea of engagement or betrothal fit into this concept at all? Jesus and the Pharisees weren't even discussing that. They were talking about marriage. To show some basis for putting betrothal in here, many times the proponents of this view will argue that Jewish betrothal was the same as, and therefore as binding as, marriage. Doesn't it seem a little strange to argue that marriage and betrothal are equally binding, and then say that real marriage is indissoluble and betrothal is not? Doesn't that seem a little bit strange? If they're equally binding, then how come one is indissoluble and the other is not? As a matter of fact, if betrothal were the same as marriage, why would the couple who was betrothed still need to be married if betrothal is the same? There are two arguments for this view, and I want to mention both of them. One argument for this view is that both betrothal and marriage are the same because they both involved a formal agreement and they both required a divorce to get out of them. And that's true. They did both require a divorce to get out of them, and they did both involve a formal agreement. But that doesn't make betrothal and marriage the same. The fact that you need a license to drive and a license to fish doesn't mean that driving and fishing are the same thing, even though you need a license for each one of them. It shows that there's a similarity there in a way, but it doesn't make them the same at all. In divorce, both in Jewish marriage and Jewish betrothal, there was a formal notification of severance that was required, but that in no way indicates that betrothal and marriage were the same thing. Now, another argument that's used sometimes is that the couple are actually referred to as husband and wife during the betrothal period. And that's true to a certain extent. Remember, Joseph was told, "Fear not to take unto thee, marry thy wife." They weren't married yet. "Fear not to take unto thee, marry thy wife." The trouble with that argument is that with regard to the terms husband and wife, in the Greek language as in the Hebrew, there is no specific word for husband or wife. You have the word for man, you have the word for woman, and the rest is determined by context. So any of these expressions, husband, wife, betrothed, fiancé, whatever your translation says, is determined by context on the general words for man and woman. These words under discussion mean, as they stand alone, man and woman, and any more specific meaning than that is derived from context. So fear not unto to take unto thee, marry thy woman. She's his woman in the sense that he is engaged to her. Those who believe, by the way, and this is kind of a side point, but it's relevant. Those who believe that 1 Corinthians 7, verses 36 through 38, about either the virgin daughter or your own virginity, whichever position you take on that little bracket of verses there, those who believe that that passage in 1 Corinthians 7 is referring to an engaged couple or a fiancé, have a problem if they also hold this betrothal view of Matthew 19:9. And I've talked with people who didn't see what the problem there is. I think there's a definite contradiction there, because if you take the betrothal view of Matthew 19:9, he's talking about breaking an engagement, and yet you take this portion in 1 Corinthians 7:36 and following as referring to an engaged couple, you have Paul and Jesus contradicting each other. This requires Paul to say that it's better if they don't get married, while Jesus is saying that the betrothal can't be broken except for fornication. So that is an encumbrance we place upon ourselves when we take on this betrothal view of Matthew 19 and 9. I think that is not a realistic explanation of Matthew 19, verse 9 at all. The exception clause in Matthew 19 and 9, stating that divorce for adultery and subsequent remarriage are proper, is Jesus' definitive statement on this issue. And although he certainly does not require divorce in such a case, he indicates that it is proper, or maybe he indicates, should I say, that it is permissible under those circumstances. He teaches that as a general rule, divorce and remarriage are not permissible, but sexual unfaithfulness is regarded as such a serious sin that it and it alone is acceptable as grounds for divorce and remarriage. Adultery, then, is not to be regarded as merely another in a series of imperfections that we find in our spouse and which we as spouses should overlook. Rather, it's regarded as a heinous crime against the marriage relationship itself. Now, is it possible to abuse the Lord's exception? Of course it is. It's possible to abuse about anything. And I've known people who went a long way with this. I've known husbands and wives who have schemed and connived behind the scenes to try to help their spouses in the direction of committing fornication so they could get out of their marriage with a scriptural right to remarriage. I don't know who people think they're kidding. In so doing, they just become accessories before the fact, and they remind me of Gehazi coming back to where Elisha was and acting like everything was just fine. Elisha said, "Don't you know I'm a man of God? Don't you know I could see what you were doing with Naaman out there?" Who do people think they're kidding on this? In attempting to abuse the divorce privilege which the Lord does allow, be not deceived. God is not mocked. I am certainly not suggesting that it's better for a Christian whose mate has committed fornication to immediately say, "Aha, I've caught you, I'm going to divorce you and find somebody else." Not at all. Particularly in cases where the fornicator is penitent, truly sorry and repentant, I hope that you would forgive. I hope that you would maintain the relationship. As a matter of fact, I personally believe that a person who refuses to forgive a penitent mate is on extremely dangerous, serious ground, because we have so many passages, and we talked yesterday about this same subject. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. There will be judgment without mercy to him who has showed no mercy. James 2:13. If thy brother sin, rebuke him. If he repent, forgive him. Luke 17:3. And on and on and on. What's the book of Hosea about? It's a book about this very theme. So we need to learn to forgive. What about the parable of the unmerciful servant, which we talked about in Matthew 18? We need to work toward the healing of the marriage, even if adultery has been involved. It may be correct in some circumstances for us to inform the mate of a fornicator that he or she can divorce. Perhaps it is not for us to advise that he or she should divorce. Let's all work for the healing of these marriages. But if the offended party does decide to divorce under circumstances of adultery in the mate, then I believe that he or she has a right to remarry according to Jesus. Now, what about the so-called Pauline privilege of 1 Corinthians 7:15? We need to cover this because it's often brought up. And I don't believe it applies with the right to remarriage. I know you don't all agree with me on this. Let me state my case here. 1 Corinthians 7:15 reads thus, and I want to read it again, though I read it a while ago. If the unbelieving departs, talking about a mixed marriage, one Christian, not one non-Christian. If the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us to peace. Now notice first of all that this passage does not mention remarriage, says nothing whatsoever about it. Since Jesus stated in the passages we just read, in Matthew 5 and Matthew 19, that there's only one valid ground for divorce and remarriage, I ask you, how can there be another valid ground for it? Anywhere Paul mentions the possibility of remarriage, he also mentions the death of the spouse. We find it in Romans 7, 2 and 3, which we read. We find it in 1 Corinthians 7, 39, which we read. We find it in 1 Timothy 5, 14, which we did not read, but the same idea is there. Paul makes no reference to remarriage except in the case of the death of a spouse. For a marriage that ends short of death, reconciliation or a single life are the only two alternatives that Paul mentions in his writings. And we find that here in chapter 7, verse 11. But if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife. So when Paul is speaking about the biblical and the legal aspect of being bound to one's partner in marriage, he uses a particular expression in the Greek language. But here he uses a different verb when he refers to the kind of duty or subjection he's talking about here. Here he uses doulo, which is the word for slavery. And he's saying that the believer is freed from this in 1 Corinthians 7, 15. This expression doulo means to make a slave of. The same word that's used of the women in Titus when it says they're not to be enslaved to much wine. Same expression there. Now, marriage is never viewed biblically as slavery. Never. He's not talking here of marriage as slavery. He's talking about a little different kind of slavery here, as I understand it. If the unbeliever departs, it's not the Christian's responsibility that the unbeliever departed. You lived with him the best you could. You tried to live a Christian life. This is all assumed in this. That you did the best you could as a Christian. Then if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. The brother or sister is not enslaved to attempt to continue to maintain a togetherness at the expense of fidelity to the Lord. In other words, the Christian is not obliged to prevent the breaking up of that mixed marriage between Christian and non-Christian. This relieves the Christian of any sense of guilt that they might have about somehow trying to get their mate to change their desire to leave. If the unbelieving partner departs, then the unbeliever is not under bondage to preserve that union through all kinds of legal maneuvering or by pursuing the unwilling partner all over the Roman Empire. That's what I understand him to be saying to the people at Corinth here. Enslaved is set in contrast against the idea of peace. Christ's prohibition against divorce does not enslave the believer to maintain a togetherness against the wishes of the unbelieving partner who insists on leaving. But Paul says nothing in this verse about a second marriage for the deserted spouse. It's just not stated here. I don't believe it can be substantiated by any exegesis of this verse. And to conclude that remarriage is allowable here is to go beyond the clearly stated words of the text. So I believe that the burden of proof lies with those who would argue that Paul permits the deserted Christian to remarry. To me, all not under bondage means is that you're not a slave to an uneasy conscience because you had to make a decision between Jesus Christ and your partner. If the unbeliever insists on it, then it should be granted for the sake of peace. Let's not read into the context that which simply is not there. Paul doesn't say here or anywhere that a Christian spouse deserted by a non-believer may be married to somebody else. You are not a slave in that you have to go with him, that you must maintain that relationship at all cost. You're not under bondage. You're not under bondage for him to then come back later and demand sex from you, as often happens. What used to be your responsibility, what used to be your due benevolence, will now be slavery if you continue to submit to that kind of harassment. You are not under slavery to reconcile with him if he comes back and plays all kinds of mind games in your head about the children and so forth. Not under that kind of slavery. He decided to leave. Sister, you gave it everything you had while you were in the relationship. You gave it your best shot. You exhausted all your resources to save this man, and he rejected it. And you're not enslaved to try to reconcile with that man because God has called us to peace, not to discord. But that does not mean you're free to be remarried to somebody else. As a matter of fact, it would seem to me that there is no subsequent marriage in view here from the next verse, verse 16. What knowest thou, O wife, whether thou shalt save thy husband? And how knowest thou, O man, whether thou shalt save thy wife? Even after the unbeliever has departed, it seems that Paul sees the possibility of a reunion there. So I don't believe that 1 Corinthians 7 adds another reason beyond Matthew 19 and 9 for divorce and remarriage. Now, I believe that if the Christian is divorced for any other reason than the exception Jesus gave in the book of Matthew, he or she does not have a right to remarry and should not remarry. And I believe if they do remarry, that they're on very dangerous ground in the sight of the Lord. I believe that this is an adulterous relationship and that they ought to get out of it. This is my personal understanding. Doing wrong does not grant us privileges which we would not have had we done right. And we cannot continue in a relationship with someone to whom we have no right. To me, that's what the part about being a eunuch is doing in there. Now, I said I wanted to leave time for discussion. I haven't left as much as I wanted to, but I'm going to pause and see if anybody has something to ask or say. Lowell.
Back to the couple that are married, splitting. Say my wife divorces. My wife divorces me. It sounds like I am animal. I am bound to commit adultery, even though we didn't break up because of adultery. Would you comment on that?
If I understand what you're saying, you're talking about causing you to commit adultery. I think Paul's just looking at people as people generally are. That's the only sense in which I believe he's using that expression. Because you obviously don't have to, but in general, people are going to, as he knew people. I think that's all he's saying there. Did you have a thought on that?
I just thought, how can you make somebody...
No, you can't. Make somebody commit adultery. No. And I believe that adultery is still to be defined in the pretty much traditional sense. We're talking here about the illicit sexual intercourse with someone who is not our spouse. Steve.
Because Paul speaks so plainly about the sexual desires in that 7th chapter, 1 Corinthians, could we reconcile verse 15 with Matthew 19 as far as the justifiable reason? Because, for instance, you have one spouse who is a believer and one who is not. Mm-hmm. And because of their pagan backgrounds, much of their activities would involve explicit sexual sins, mm-hmm. activities.
Especially in Corinth.
So, in other words, the unbeliever says, well, now you want to be a Christian and you don't want to do these things anymore, mm-hmm. so I'm leaving. Mm-hmm. Just for clarification for those that might find themselves in a comparable situation today where the unbeliever departed and the sexual sin being a part of that picture. Mm-hmm. If we could just reconcile the two.
Are you asking me a question?
Yes.
Go ahead.
The adultery or fornication clause.
Yes.
Reconciling that with the unbeliever departing.
If there's adultery involved, then you would have a right to remarry. Yes. Bob, you got one of it? Cliff.
It has fallen my lot, I'll put it that way, to do some counseling in this area. And I want to know whether I'm teaching correctly or not, if I am in that position again. I have always taken the stand that in the first part of 1 Corinthians, the 7th chapter, that it shows a definite obligation of solving, if possible, the problems of where one person is not content with the other one because of sexual relations.
Right.
And I feel that part of the problem sometimes is inhibitions that they have grown up with that aren't in the Bible.
True.
And I believe that what happens between a man and wife, I'm speaking only between men and married men and women who are faithful to one another. I believe a person would be hard-pressed to say that certain inhibitions, whatever, are wrong in God's sight. If it is not wrong in God's sight, then it boils down to what the person has been raised to feel about it. And I do not believe that one spouse has the authentic power to force the other one to do something that they themselves cannot, with a clear conscience, do.
No.
And the reason I believe that is because the book does say that that which is without faith is sin. If you believe it's wrong, then it is wrong.
The ideal of God stated in Genesis 2:25 was they were both naked, the man and his wife, and they were not ashamed, completely unzipped with each other. But we're not ideal people, and if we're married to somebody who has some inhibitions, we need to talk and work with them and have sympathy and embrace them in a relationship of security. Go ahead.
And if the problem cannot be solved, that's still no excuse for somebody taking off.
Absolutely not.
And they should learn to live
Absolutely.
With it.
That's our
Another audience. Thing that I have always stated, and I want to know if it's true or not, and that is that there are no conditions to justify the basis of the introduction of sexual intercourse with people just because they become engaged.
No.
I have never believed that, and I just want to know that if this thing ever comes up for me to be talking to somebody in the future, I don't want to tell them something that's wrong.
You're exactly
Physically,
right, as I understand.
Mentally, emotionally, or spiritually, I don't want to tell them something that's wrong.
Right.
It's too critical in human life and human behavior to be wrong
right.
willingly.
There's no true commitment without marriage, because marriage is the commitment. Intercourse, even one day before the wedding, is wrong. I think that you're reading the same book I'm reading. Thank you, Cliff. I don't know where we are here. Oh, Joanne.
I don't know if I heard you correctly, but you, when you gave us all the scriptures regarding divorce, and you said that a brother or a sister cannot be divorced except by what is stated here, are you saying that these specific scriptures are not for the unbeliever? Are they not for people that have not come to Christ yet, who have not obeyed the gospel? Are these scriptures not for them also?
I'm not sure if I understand precisely what you're asking. Paul told us in 1 Corinthians 7, let every man abide in the same state he's in when he's called. I think if people in the world are baptized into Christ, if they're married to each other, we accept that marriage. And it seems to me that God accepts that marriage at that time. They are married to each other. And I think, behold, I make all things new applies to that. Does that touch what you're asking? No,
but then
I'm sorry.
You've got people in the world that have been divorced.
Yes.
Then they come to Christ.
Yes.
Then they choose to live according to this. Would that be that if they were in the world and read these scriptures wouldn't apply to them? This is saying that they've read these same scriptures before they obeyed the gospel, but yet they got divorced. Would that mean that these scriptures did not apply to them at that time?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by apply to them. Marvin, are you on the same thing?
Will God enforce them on people in the world?
Well, certainly they apply, but the people in the world are already lost anyway. So as far as condition of the soul, it doesn't matter that much what the situation is. But I personally believe that baptism washes that past away, and that whoever they're married to at the time that they come to Christ, that is regarded by God as a valid marriage, a non-adulterous relationship, even if it was one before. And that's changed at that point. And I base that on the statement in 1 Corinthians 7, art thou bound unto a wife, seek not to be loosed. That idea of coming to, we don't really have time to read that whole context there, but he's talking about the state in which you come to Christ, remain in that state. I think it's different after we've come to Christ, though, and then we start dilly-dallying with all of this. I don't know where we go. Marvin or Fonda? I guess Fonda first and then Marvin.
I'd like to have some comments on what I consider the waiting game. Okay, mm-hmm. We're a Christian couple, and we decide we want to get divorced, and then we wait to see who's going to fall first so the other one can scripturally remarry.
I understand the Lord to say that this divorce needs to be for the cause of fornication. And what happens after we're already divorced is somewhat irrelevant to this. I don't think either one of them has a right to remarry. Marvin?
I was always under the impression that bondage Romans were the same, exactly the same word.
I don't know about that. I'd have to check that.
She's not under bondage so long as her husband lives, but if her husband be dead, she's free. Mm-hmm. Then in Corinthians, if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. Does depart just mean walk out the door? Or does that mean the relationship is ended in God's sight and the believer is left to suffer the consequences even if they never had anything to do with it or even if they weren't responsible for it?
I really think that, and I don't like it, but I think that. And there are lots of situations in life where that can happen, where the actions of somebody else can severely retard or even completely prohibit your privileges.
But are you saying that if my wife walked out on me, she's an unbeliever, if she is an unbeliever and she leaves me,
yes,
and never has anything to do with me again, mm-hmm, then I'm duty bound never to marry again. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
I think I'm free from bondage. If I'm free from bondage, then I'm free from any ties to her. Seems to me like you're separating the obligations of serving him or her from the ties that bind them together. And it seems to me like if the contract's broken, it's broken. It's gone. Kaput.
I understand your position. I think somebody can... Well, we're about to run out of time here. Maybe we better take another comment. Okay.
What if both parties commit adultery and then one of the parties divorce, can they get married?
Well, then we get in. Let me just summarize that whole area, since we're about out of time, by saying to you that when we have these positions presented to these situations presented to us, what we come up with are three general areas. Sometimes we have a situation in which we can say they absolutely do have a right to remarry. Sometimes we have a situation where we can say they absolutely don't. And there is a middle area where sometimes people are in such convoluted situations that we can't be sure, or at least I can't be sure, whether they have a right to remarry or not. And in those cases, I can only apply what I hope I would apply to myself. If I'm not sure, then I don't want to do it. Now, in a case like that, you might want to try to find out who committed it first and so forth. But that gets awfully tricky. That's all the more incentive for us to keep our lives pure and not get ourselves in these kind of situations. Thank you very much for your time and attention. We'll have our 10-minute break. We can discuss privately if you'd like to.